And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Melissa Ginsberg to the program today. Melissa teaches English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi, having received her MFA from the prestigious Iowa Writers Workshop. As a writer, she is a poet and a novelist, having published the collection of poems, Dear Weather Ghost, and Echo HarperCollins has recently published her debut novel, Sunset City. Melissa, Charlotte Ford is the narrator of Sunset City, and as the book opens, she's heading back to her apartment with some takeout, and there's a strange man waiting there for her. Who is he?
He is a detective, Detective Ash, who's investigating the murder of Danielle Reeves, who's Charlotte's friend.
Before she learns that fact, even though he's a bit older, she finds him strangely attractive. An Irish nose, was it?
Yeah, well, he's an attractive man. Yeah, and she's a little bit flirty in general. She's also on her way home. Her arms are full because she's been out to get some food, and it's raining really hard. So she has to stand very close to him under the awning in order to get out of the rain. So there's a kind of a forced intimacy there that she responds to.
And it's set in Houston, Texas, and it's very appropriate. This spring has been one of the wettest ever, it seems, down that way.
Yeah, I mean, Houston floods a lot, and it always has. I think it's getting worse because they just keep paving more of the wetlands, so there's nowhere for that water to go. Unfortunately, it's a big problem in Houston, and I'm not sure if they're going to be able to solve it.
Now, she was best friends with Danielle, but it's been a few years since they were close with each other. They hadn't seen each other much recently, had they?
No, they were best friends in high school, and when this book takes place, they're in their early 20s. They're like 24, maybe. Danielle has gone to prison for drug possession. She's been through rehab, and she's been out for a little while and trying to rebuild her life. So during all of that, Charlotte and Danielle lost touch.
Because Danielle had to kind of separate herself from her previous life to get straight.
Yeah, that's the idea. I think that that happens a lot when one friend moves away or is taken away in this case. They just lost touch, but they never really stopped thinking about each other. They still are very important in each other's lives. And Danielle is very present for Charlotte, even though they have not been in touch.
As we learn throughout the course of the book, their friendship, starting in middle school or junior high, was very intense.
Yeah, it was very intense. Danielle is a charismatic figure. She's a beautiful, rich girl. She's smart. She's funny. And she has the kind of social power in school that Charlotte is very attracted to. They mean a lot for each other. They're both girls who the adults in their lives aren't really there for them. So they have taken care of each other, they've helped each other, and they have helped each other become the women that they are.
And both fathers, I guess we have left the family, we never really find out what happens to Charlotte's father, do we?
Charlotte's father is never around. She's never known him, and he's just a non-entity in her life. She was raised by her mother, but a lot of her childhood was spent taking care of her mother because her mother was very ill. So yeah, Charlotte does not have a dad and has had to, since a real early age, take on this caretaking role.
You see it a lot with children of alcoholics and addicts that they crave structure. And
yes.
A little bit of order. Mm-hmm. And while Danielle's mother was a very important property developer, revitalizing the downtown area, she's the kind that lashes out and acts out in order to get her mother's attention, it seems.
Because her mother is so wealthy, Danielle can afford to be reckless because she has that to fall back on. She and her mother don't get along and they're not close, but she does come from a wealthy and privileged background. So she knows that if anything goes really wrong, you know, there's that safety net. She acts out and is a lot more careless than Charlotte is.
But ironically enough, she's the one that gets caught and put in jail. And Charlotte wonders through the course of the book about moral luck and that she did many of the same things that Danielle did, but she didn't go to jail.
Yeah, that's true. So Charlotte did drugs with Danielle, but not to the extent that Danielle did. Charlotte is not an addict. She experimented and found it easy to walk away from the hard drugs that Danielle was doing. She was a heroin addict, and that's why she went to prison. But Charlotte thinks about the fact that, you know, even being an addict or not is luck. They were exposed to the same drugs. And Charlotte is lucky that she did not get addicted, that she did not find it as appealing as Danielle found it. She says at one point in the book, they both always did whatever they wanted to do. And it was just luck that the things that Charlotte wanted to do were not as dangerous for her.
When Detective Ash is questioning her and brings up Danielle's background with drugs and her job as a stripper, Charlotte has a very visceral reaction that he knows that about her and that's what he thinks of her.
Yeah, Charlotte is not a judgmental person, and she's fiercely protective of Danielle. She cares about her a lot. She admires her. She knows more about Danielle's secrets than anyone else knows, so she understands a lot of the motivation behind Danielle's self-destructive behavior. But she also knows how it looks. Like, if the only facts that you know about a person are that she has been in prison for heroin and has worked as a stripper, then you form an idea about that person that's quite incomplete. So Charlotte doesn't want anybody to think about Danielle that way, because Danielle is much more than those two facts about her life.
Even though they had not been in contact frequently, it was just two nights before that she had a chance to talk to Danielle.
Yes, they're reunited, and Charlotte is hoping that this is the beginning of a new part of their friendship, that they'll reconnect and be in each other's lives. And she's looking forward to that. She's excited about it. She's happy to see that Danielle is clean, that she seems to be doing well. She looks healthy. And they pretty much pick up where they left off.
And it was at that meeting she meets Danielle's friend, Audrey. They're in business together.
Yeah. So Danielle and Audrey work together making internet porn. The two of them and a filmmaker that they're also friends with. Then there's a bunch of other actors that they're involved with. Yeah, but they are the two sort of stars of this little business.
The director.
Yes.
His name's Brandon
Young.
And he works at a public access channel during the day. And I can tell you, yeah, public media doesn't pay a whole lot.
No, it does not. Brandon is an interesting figure because he's not the sort of sleazy person that you might imagine when you find out that he makes pornography. He's an artist. He's a filmmaker. He makes these experimental films that are non-narrative and gets them into festivals. He also believes in community television, and he's very supportive of the arts in his community and of access to free speech, that kind of thing. And then he's got a huge amount of student loan debt because he went to art school. And so that's how he fell into pornography. He's kind of a sweet guy, and he's an artist. And he, for a pornographer, is, I think, pretty moral and non-threatening.
When Charlotte met with Danielle, that wasn't happenstance. She had a reason for calling Danielle up.
Charlotte calls Danielle because she received a call from Danielle's mother. And Danielle's mother, Sally, needed to get in touch with Danielle to let her know that Danielle's great aunt died and left her an inheritance. So this is the start of the book, the thing that springs everything into action. Sally bribes Charlotte in order to get Danielle's phone number. And Charlotte is not comfortable, you know, giving Sally Danielle's number without Danielle knowing, because she knows that Danielle and Sally, the mother and daughter, do not get along. And she knows that Danielle doesn't want to be blindsided by a phone call from her mother. So she calls Danielle, or she texts Danielle right away and says, I have to tell you this thing that happened. I have to see you. So that's why they get together. Charlotte offers Danielle half of the money that Sally gave her for the phone number. She feels like it belongs to Danielle and she wouldn't feel comfortable keeping it. So that's the impetus for them reuniting. And then their meeting goes well. They enjoy spending time together. They have a couple of drinks and make plans to meet the following week. So yeah, Charlotte's not thrilled to hear from Sally. She's not real comfortable around Sally, but she is grateful to be back in touch with her friend.
And Sally had given Charlotte $1,000.
Yes.
For that piece of information.
Danielle is very principled. She does not like her mother for a lot of very complicated reasons and doesn't want anything to do with her. And she's very independent. And she's found a way to support herself without her mother's help. So once she finds out that that money is from Sally, she refuses to take it.
And Sally is involved in property development, always has a very put-on face and an appearance. Appearance is very important in her business. But I would guess her developments are shiny on the outside and probably not the best on the inside, the way she lives her life.
I feel a lot of sympathy for Sally, actually. It's not easy to be a successful woman in Texas in, you know, like she's a real estate developer. She's involved in all of the politics that that entails. And it does matter a lot how you look, how you're perceived. Sally's very careful about putting on this veneer that is very polished and very steely. And she has to do that in order to survive in the very male-dominated, you know, power structure of Texas business. And she is alone in it. So yeah, she really falls back on that armor that she puts up. And sometimes she neglects things that are perhaps more internal.
Well, and you have to have sympathy for all your characters. If you don't have some little bit for them, they become kind of two-dimensional. So you have to round them out. And that detail of Charlotte seeing Sally wearing pantyhose without shoes and seeing her painted toenails beneath the hose, mm-hmm. and just feeling that that was too intimate was just a really nice touch.
Yeah, Charlotte has only ever seen Sally very polished and very in control and comfortable. And when she sees Sally in the wake of Danielle's death, grieving and less put together, she sees her at home with her shoes off. Charlotte is not comfortable with that version of Sally. And Sally is not comfortable with that version of herself either. She's much more comfortable when she's in control of the situation and can manipulate people and get them to do what she wants them to do. And she's struggling to get back to that way of being in the world while she's dealing with her daughter's death. And it's really hard for her.
And the reason she wanted to get in contact with her is that her aunt, Danielle's great aunt, Baby, had died. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a story behind the name Aunt Baby.
I have known some ladies named Baby, and I think it was a generational thing. They were, when I knew them, elderly. And maybe that's a Texas thing or New Orleans thing. But yeah, I've known some babies. There was one baby in particular who was, I think, in her 70s when I knew her when I was a child. And she was the youngest in her family. She had a lot of brothers and sisters, and they just always called her Baby. And she grew up with Baby as her name. You know, I just always liked that. I like to think of an old lady named Aunt Baby.
And she had property out in Tomball, Texas, mm-hmm. which is out northwest toward College Station. What kind of place is Tomball?
You know, I haven't actually spent a whole lot of time there. It's a suburb, basically, of Houston, but it was pretty rural. And so it sort of shifted from being rural to suburban. So I was interested in just taking advantage of that in terms of narrative. Sally is a real estate developer. She ends up with some land and she wants to develop it. Like, the timing of that is good for her. But Tomball is not a place that I have spent a lot of time in. It's a place that growing up in Houston, I was just aware of.
Before I read Sunset City and Attica Locke's Blackwater Rising, mm-hmm. the only things I knew about Houston came from H-Town Hip Hop and from Reality Bites.
Yeah.
Do you have like any entertainment touchstones, either books or movies that you could identify with the way it presented Houston?
I mean, there's not a lot of things that are set in Houston. I will say that I did not recognize the Houston of Reality Bites very clearly. That did not seem like my city. I think Attica Locke is great. But for such a large American city, it's not depicted much. And it's not really a part of our cultural conversation. You know, people don't think about it much if they haven't been there. It's not like New York or New Orleans or Los Angeles. It's not one of those iconic places. So no, like, there aren't a lot of Houston books or movies that I could point to and say, yeah, that's it. Which is one of the reasons it was fun to write about. I could just write my Houston.
Did it help to be away from Houston while writing the book?
I think it helped in some ways. In some ways, it forced me to do some more research. I haven't lived in Houston in 13 years. And when I went to write about it, I was surprised to find out that I couldn't remember things like the order of the streets, that kind of thing. Like, I would be writing a transition scene when Charlotte is driving somewhere, and I'd have to look at maps in order to remind myself of where she would get off on the freeway, you know? So, but it did give me a perspective on Houston that I didn't have when I was living there. And it also, I think one of the things that led me to write the book is when I was living in Houston, I really wanted to leave. And then once I left, I was surprised to find that I missed it, that I felt homesick in ways that were quite unexpected. And I still didn't want to live there, but I also missed it. And that sort of ambivalence towards the city informs a lot of the emotional content of Sunset City, I think. I think that's, like, a lot of the characters feel that way about Houston and also about each other. You know, they care about each other, but they can't be together, that kind of thing. I'm interested in the emotional complexity of that situation.
And how's your transition to living in Iowa and now Mississippi been, living in the country, essentially?
I love living in Mississippi. I really enjoy it here. I understand it a lot better culturally. My parents are from Louisiana, and I grew up in Texas, and I've spent a lot of time in Alabama and New Orleans. I'm just much more comfortable in the South, and it feels like home to me here in a way that the Midwest never did. I never felt very comfortable in Iowa or like I understood what was going on, and I hated the winters. So I love it down here, and I write really well here, and I'm happy to be part of this great community in Oxford.
Yeah, it seems Oxford has kind of a lockdown on literary crime fiction nowadays with Tommy Franklin and Beth Ann's book, Chris Offutt, William Boyle, mm-hmm. and then Megan Abbott was a writer in residence here.
Mm-hmm. Ace Atkins.
Ace Atkins, yeah. And Emma Walsh's book was uh-huh. A wonderful book too.
Uh-huh.
What is it about this place?
I don't know. I don't know what it is about this place. I think that there's something going on here in terms of just the literary community. There's so many writers here who are writing really well right now, and that's exciting to be a part of. I also think that there's not a snobbery towards genre that exists here, and some literary communities do have that, you know, where crime is considered sort of less valuable than a more literary book. I think that the writers in Oxford are not concerned about that supposed hierarchy. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, all of those writers that you mentioned, we're all just sort of working independently and happen to be here. And we're also all friends with each other, but we were writing that stuff before a lot of us met. So, it just happens that way.
A lot of people refer to Sunset City as noir.
Yeah.
And along with the noir tag, there's the colorful turns of phrases and an economy of style that often hallmarks noir. Do you think your background and your also writing as a poet has informed and helped that noir style?
I think that it's certainly informed it. It's maybe like my background as a poet, it could be that that is what is making people think that this book is noir. I think that both poems and noir are very compressed and economical. And I wasn't trying to write noir when I set out. I mean, I wanted to write a crime novel, and I like a certain kind of crime novel that is steeped in place and character. And I wanted to write a book that was well written. But I'm also a compulsive reviser and editor. I cut a lot of pages, you know, I just whittled it down until I was happy with it. So that is just sort of the writing style that I'm comfortable with. And so it ended up being that way. I didn't want extra stuff in it. I didn't want anything that would distract from the momentum of the plot. So yeah, I think that just my tendencies, my habits as a writer sort of created that style.
With your tendency toward revision, how do you know when to let go?
There are many times when I thought that the book was finished, and then I set it aside for a while and went back to it and made a lot more changes. Honestly, if it weren't published, I would probably still be doing that. I'd probably still be cutting and changing. But I think at a certain point, I knew that the book was, even though I could tweak the sentences or shift a couple of things around, the heart of the book was there, and it made the kind of moves that I was interested in making. And, you know, I have a bunch of readers that I really trusted. My editor and my agent were really helpful. A lot of friends looked at the book. My husband, Chris Offit, read the book and is a great editor. So I have those readers whose feedback I really trust, and I gave it a lot of time. I'm a slow writer, and I need time away from the book in order to be able to see it with fresh eyes. And so I think that once it was to a point that I was able to get an agent and sell it, then I just really trusted that process, that editorial process.
Now, often noir deals with people on the edges. There's a little bit less moral judgment on the characters as they go through. And I thought it was really interesting about Charlotte. At one point, she's a little bit drunk, a little bit high, and she says, "I like to be saved. More people should try to save me. They should save me all the time." Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem like a contemporary thought. It seems more something from an older time.
Huh. I mean, I don't know if I could speak to that, because I think that there are lots of people who still think that way. Charlotte is someone who's had to take care of herself and other people her whole life. And in that moment when she is drunk, she's stoned, she's particularly sad, you know, about Danielle's death. She feels very alone. She's very vulnerable in that moment, and she just allows herself to want that in a way that she can't really afford to admit most of the time, because nobody's there to save her. She knows that.
Yeah, I mean, she's the one that's been having to do the saving with her mom over the years.
And with Danielle. Yeah.
And so that's a lot of stress to put on a person to have them be hypervigilant for that long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Charlotte is really strong, though. Most of the time she can take it. But yeah, there are moments in the book when she's just exhausted by all of that.
And lest we think of Detective Ash is kind of this white knight type. He has the ability to do the wrong thing several times and say the wrong thing that just kind of puts Charlotte on edge. Mm-hmm. He shows her the photographs from the crime scene. Mm-hmm. He implies that it might have been her fault with Danielle being killed. I wasn't really sure if he was clumsy or if that was part of the detective game of trying to throw people off and make them vulnerable.
When he shows Charlotte those photographs of the crime scene, he does it out of frustration. So he's someone who's, like everyone in the book, not entirely in control of himself. He's a good cop, he's a good person, but like everyone, he makes some bad decisions. And he's impulsive. Because he is such a good man, he resents that Charlotte thinks he's judging this victim. And so she inadvertently accuses him of the thing that he's most defensive about. And so he's reacting to that in that moment. It does not go well, and he feels terrible about it. She's so shocked by seeing these photos that she faints. She hits her head in the interview room in the police station. So then he has to deal with the aftermath of that. But he likes Charlotte. He recognizes that she's had a really difficult life and that she has come out of it sort of okay, you know? She's still struggling. She's still really young. But, you know, he recognizes that she's responsible, that she's smart, that she's kind.
I read the book a couple of days ago, and I just heard a podcast yesterday. There's a guy named Merlin Mann, and he used the phrase, "Every glass is temporarily unbroken." And that really just resonated me and with the themes in the book. It's just there's life, but, you know, there's pain and there's damage coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this book does not shy away from difficulty. And even when things are I read an interview with Mary Gateskill the other day, and she said something like, even when things are going really well, you'll still eventually start to feel bad about them. And I love Mary Gateskill's work, and I love that sentiment. You know, even when things are good, they're still difficult and hard. Like, that's what being a human being is about, you know? And so I didn't want to shy away from that in this book. And to me, that's what makes characters interesting to read about, and that it's those vulnerabilities and those difficulties and the way that people deal with them that makes literature appealing to me. And, you know, I'm interested in that in people in real life too. You know, that's how you get to know somebody, is if you know the difficult things about them as well.
How did Charlotte's voice come to you in the first place?
I don't know. I wrote so much of her, and I wrote so many pages that I threw away, like hundreds of pages. I just wrote and wrote and wrote until she started to sound right to me, until she started to really seem to be a complete person making decisions on her own. I knew the situation that she was in before I started, but it took me a while to understand how she would react in any particular moment. So I just did that through writing. She has some things in common with me and with other people that I know, but, you know, I just wrote until she seemed like herself.
Do you think she changed in your mind over that process?
My sense of her, that was this sort of pre-verbal understanding of who Charlotte was, I think was pretty solid from the beginning, and how to put that into language and how to maneuver her through the events of the book, like, that took me a while to figure out. But I think she was always there from the beginning.
Do you think you would ever revisit Charlotte as a character in your writing?
At this point, it's doubtful, because I'm interested in writing more books in this genre. And Charlotte's not a detective. She just has some bad things happen to her, and then she has to deal with them. So if I were to write about Charlotte again, and it was going to be realistic, then I don't think I could write noir. It would have to be Charlotte doing something else, or else I just torture her and, like, make her new best friend die too, you know, which seems terrible and unrealistic. So yeah, at this point, I think I'm probably going to just let Charlotte go live her life somewhere else. But I don't know. I mean, I still love her. I still have quite a lot of affection for her. So we'll see.
And I'm sorry not to let you enjoy Sunset City, but do you have anything else in the works?
Yeah, I'm working on a new novel that's going to be set in New Orleans and the Alabama Gulf Coast. It's going to be another literary noir. It's about a 13, 14-year-old girl who moves from Iowa to New Orleans to live with her grandmother. And there's some crime element, some thriller elements.
Well, Melissa, I want to thank you so much for letting us talk to you today about Sunset City.
Thank you, Stephen.
Melissa Ginsberg is the author of Sunset City, which is available from HarperCollins. And this week, I'd like to welcome a new affiliate to the Book Talk family, Classic Book Radio, WMFH-FM in Columbus, Mississippi. We'd like to give our best to all of our new friends and listeners down in Mississippi's Golden Triangle. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.